At Public.com, you can earn 5.1% APY with a high-yield cash account. And while we can't say it's officially the highest interest rate out there, we can say this. It's higher than Robinhood, SoFi, Wealthfront, Capital One, and the big banks, too. Ready to start earning 5.1% APY on your cash? Check out the high-yield cash account on Public.com. This is paid for by Public Investing. 5.1% APY as of March 26, 2024, and is subject to change. A high-yield cash account is a secondary brokerage account with Public Investing, member FINRA/SIPC. Funds from this account are automatically deposited into partner banks where they earn a variable interest and are eligible for FDIC insurance. Neither Public Investing nor any of its affiliates is a bank. U.S. only. Learn more at public.com/disclosure/high-yield-account.
GDP. PCE, FOMC, we got it all going on. From American Public Media, this is Market Play. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Friday today, October the 28th. Good as always to have you along, everybody. You get sick and tired of me saying this on Fridays. I will bet you money that this has been a big week in this economy, right? Yeah, well, look, I got news for you. They are all big weeks in this economy right now. Sudeep Reddy is at Politico. It's just you and me today, Sudeep, all right?
All right.
Good. So let us start with gross domestic product. GDP comes in at 2.6% for the third quarter. That's the final read. I would like to know what's not to love in that number after the year we've had so far.
Yeah, Kai, a 2.6% rate. You think the streamer should be going out, some confetti right now. We were talking about a recession for the first two quarters, and on some definitions, you could say it was, but it wasn't really a recession. And this kind of settles it for the moment in terms of those technical GDP terms. But there was a lot under the surface. When you actually get into the guts of a GDP report, it shows consumer spending slowing, people pulling back a bit. It's just a bit of a grind in the economy. But if you were in the camp that was calling for a soft landing, then maybe you actually have you live to fight another day. Like, things aren't that bad. The economy's slowing, but not catastrophically. Some of the other measures you mentioned, PCE, the inflation report, slowing by some measures. It's obviously not nearly fast enough. But then in some other areas, we saw in this GDP report, housing contracted. Housing is in the third quarter. If you're in the housing sector, this is a hard landing. Like, no one should be arguing anything else. And it's painful in some parts of the economy, but overall, partly because of the job market, overall things are not as bad as they could be with interest rates having surged as much as they have this year.
Well, let's talk interest rates in a second. I do want to get to the PCE number, right? The headline number, and let's remember this is the Federal Reserve's preferred measure, personal consumption expenditures. This is what Jay Powell and the gang like to look at for a whole bunch of somewhat technical reasons. Comes in at 6.2% year on year at the headline level, 5.1 in the core. That's still pretty high, yo.
It's still high. The Fed's target, of course, is 2%. And if they on the core, and if they were to get to 3%, 4%, they might feel better. But 5% just isn't going to cut it. And when you look at inflation, people still feel inflation. Obviously, we're 10 days out from midterm election. Everyone's talking about it in that context. But we all still feel inflation in the economy in all sorts of ways. And all of what we felt from 2021 and the first half of this year, it's still seeping through. Obviously, there are some forward-looking indicators that maybe inflation is coming down in some areas, but it's not coming down fast enough, and it's still problematic in a lot of areas.
Well, I will not, since you're alone today on the other end of the microphone, challenge you to a game of what is Jay Powell thinking in five words or less. But why do you think everybody is guessing that it's going to be 0.75 percentage points, 75 basis points, instead of maybe them looking forward a little bit and saying, we have some disinflationary things going on. Let's do 0.5 percentage point, which would still historically be a pretty big rate increase.
So, Kai, I think, help me out. Maybe it was 5 or 6 months ago when Jay Powell had that line that this is not the time for tremendously nuanced readings on inflation. Yeah. He probably still thinks that. You can't have a PCE report this high. The CPI report a couple weeks ago on inflation was a shocker when it comes to core inflation. It was not enough progress. And unless you're really looking for some nuance here, if you're the Fed chairman who's made this commitment, you've got one job, Ajay. You've got one job. You've got to get this done. You've got to bring inflation down. And maybe a year ago you could be, and a year ago was when he kind of turned the ship and said, like, we really got to bring this down. And we're a year later, we're still not there. So he's got to look at this and think, I can't let everybody off the hook at this moment. If he lets people off the hook, the markets are going to go crazy. If you end up in this pivot,
the markets are going crazy already. I mean, come on, look at the week this week. The markets are like, yay, everything's fine.
They are, except for the tech sector.
Well, yeah, that's
parts
true.
Of it.
Yeah.
But and there is another hard landing if you're an investor in the tech sector. But in so many other areas, people are still thinking maybe it's time for a pivot. There's often this, like, right after an election, there's often like a pop in the stock market. It could happen. But Jay Powell came out at Jackson Hole months ago and he said this. He was as clear as he could be to prevent a moment like this. He was clear, like, this is when we have to actually take action as a central bank.
And he did it in a breathtakingly and mercifully short 8.5 minutes. What do you make, by the way, just to get tangential here for a second, what do you make of Sherrod Brown, who chairs the banking committee in the Senate, and also John Hickenlooper, senator from Colorado, of them sending him very public letters saying, hey, Jay, don't forget about the other side of the dual mandate. It's not just stable prices, it's jobs.
Yeah, you know, Democrats weren't talking about this 6 months ago as much. They needed this fixed like 6 months ago. And the fact that it's not fixed, but some of them are actually thinking, well, don't break the labor market, which hasn't broken yet. And they want to make sure that they're on the record saying that. Some of them, not these particular senators who stepped up this week, some of them are obviously looking toward races in 2024 and don't want things broken in that sense. And so there's a little bit of politics going on here and positioning. But they all know that Jay Powell has one job here, and they've mostly let him off the hook to take action how he needs to.
Okay, another political question, this one over in the UK. So I wanted to get to this last week, but we ran out of time. I wanted to put it to Catherine, so we called you so I can put it to you. It was super interesting to me that in the whole Liz Truss mini budget debacle that they had over there that cost her job, it was the British bond market that was driving the politics and the policy, right? There were changes in policy because the bond market went nuts. We're going to have here in the spring, probably, if Republicans win the House, Republicans in Congress saying we're not going to raise the debt limit unless you, Joe Biden, cut a bunch of social services. And we're going to have, arguably, a real crisis over the debt limit. And I want to know why American markets haven't really gone crazy when mostly Republicans in Congress have played fast and loose with a full faith and credit of the United States.
I think I've been doing the rap maybe a dozen years when we've gone through this exercise. And some of the first times it was when we actually thought maybe we're actually going to break the system with the debt limit. And every time you come up to the line, And markets just have learned this is a game that's going to be played. And as you get closer and closer to the line, you get a little bit of the freak out. You see certain things on the yield curve moving around, and that's fine. But nobody really thinks it's going to happen this time because you don't want to actually be the person in charge who triggers that. And so, but you got to touch the stove every once in a while, and somebody's going to want to touch the stove because that's what you do. It kind of depends on how wild the election results end up being, on whether people feel like they've got the gloves on as a result of, and want to touch the stove afterward.
Don't touch the stove, people. Don't touch the stove. Sudeep Reddy, he helps run things over at Politico. Thanks. We'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Kai. Have a great weekend.
Have a nice weekend. You too. On Wall Street today, the only question is how happy the music is going to be. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. All right, so we talked about inflation, Sudeep and I did, and that reading on PCE that we got this morning because kind of had to, right? Also, we noted the Fed meets next week, interest rate to come, obviously. But here's the deal, and this won't be the first time you've heard it on this program. There is a lag between the Fed raising rates and inflation actually coming down. So how long are we going to have to wait? Marketplace's Matt Levin is on that one.
The U.S. economy right now is kind of like an 8-year-old with an ear infection. when kids get amoxicillin for an infection, right? There's still that first 12 to 24 hours where you're just, they still feel miserable and there's not much you can do about it.
Julie Smith is an economist at Lafayette College. In this analogy, the ear infection is inflation and the amoxicillin is the Fed raising rates. But instead of 12 to 24 hours, J-PAL's medicine works slowly.
Most people would say a year to 18 months.
That's the best guess from economists, and it's a guess because raising rates is an inherently indirect way to stabilize prices. Bill English at the Yale School of Management says you can already see the impact of the Fed's rate hikes in mortgage rates and a strong dollar.
But those effects on spending take a little while to actually happen. People have habits, people have plans that they don't change.
Just how long it takes will depend on the still very tight labor market, which the Fed wants to loosen. But Michael Gapin at Bank of America says after 2 years of a labor shortage, employers may not be very accommodating.
If you're an employer and you cannot fill these spaces, you may not be so quick to let go of labor in any downturn.
Still, Gapin expects inflation to return to more manageable levels next year. Come March 2023, it'll be a full 12 months since the Fed started rate hikes. I'm Matt Levin for Marketplace.
So here's a story about a government program so popular that you basically can't load the website. That's the only place you can get in on the action. Today is the last day you can buy Series I government savings bonds. I for inflation, paying 9.62%. For the next 6 months, 9.62%. The rate resets every 6 months, May and November. And starting next week, I bonds are going to pay 6-point-something%. Thing is that normally I bonds aren't all that popular, right? When inflation's low, they don't offer all that great a rate of return. But as we know, inflation's not low. Marketplace's Samantha Fields is on the inflation-adjusted bond desk today.
Around noon today, Jennifer McKinnon was trying to log into her Treasury account.
Let's see if this actually works. I doubt it.
She was right. It didn't.
Man, why can't I type in anything?
McKinnon lives in New York and works in real estate. She already bought some I-bonds a couple of weeks ago, but was hoping to buy more before the deadline and get her family and friends to buy them too.
I have told so many people about this where I feel like the Treasury owes me a commission.
Before this year of high inflation,
not many people really pay much attention to I-bonds.
Zhang Nguyen is a finance professor at Penn State.
But now that we suddenly find ourselves in a very high inflation environment and most investments out there are losing values, that's why you see the rush.
There's pretty much nowhere else to get such a high rate of return guaranteed.
This year has been really tricky for anyone trying to save for the future.
Winnie Caesar at the research firm Credit Sites says she just bought I-bonds for the first time for everyone in her family.
There's still a lot of uncertainty around the economy, what are equities going to do, what is inflation going to do, and it felt like a pretty compelling opportunity.
Next week, the interest rate on I-bonds will drop from 9.62%, likely, Caesar says, to about 6.5%. I'm Samantha Fields for Marketplace.
Coming up.
The money I make from streams is like laughable. Like sometimes I'm lucky to break out of the fence.
Where does the music money come from, huh? First, though, let's do the numbers. Yeah, the really happy music. Dow Industrial's up 828 today, more than 2.5%, 32,861. The NASDAQ up 309, that's 2.8%. 11,102. S&P 500 up 93 points, 2.4%, 39.1. For the week, the Dow clocked its strongest showing since May, up 5.7%. The NASDAQ increased 2.2%, which, given the week it's had, was pretty good. S&P 500 gained 3.9%. As I alluded to there a second ago, we've seen some not-so-great earnings reports from big tech companies this week, but Apple is Apple. Its quarterly earnings beat analyst expectations for revenue. Apple grew 7.5% today. Chipmaker Intel rose as well, 10.6% with its latest quarterly results. Bond prices fell. Yield on the 10-year T-note, 4.01%. You're listening to Marketplace. With access to so much information, it's hard to feel like an informed, discerning citizen. That's why on Make Me Smart, which is a podcast from Marketplace, we make it easy for you to stay in the know. Hi, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Every weekday, Kimberly Adams and I unpack the latest from Washington, D.C.
The Senate Minority Leader has announced that he will step down as the Republican leader.
What's happening in AI? I mean, don't buy at the top, but holy cow, artificial intelligence and all the companies related to it are the hot new thing. And we do the numbers.
So as a refresher, inflation is the rate of increase in the prices of things. It's not just sort of things getting more expensive. It's the speed at which things get more expensive.
Because in a world that's constantly changing, we all need to stay smart. Listen to Make Me Smart wherever you get your podcasts. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. The Department of Education says there were just about 2 million bachelor's degrees awarded in the United States in the 2019-2020 school year. About a fifth of them were in STEM-related fields. Think computer science, biology, math as well, obviously. That's 20% of all the bachelor's degrees, which is not a lot. And one reason why is, understandably, a lot of college kids just change their minds once they get to school. In Chicago, though, that is being seen as an opportunity. Marketplace's Stephanie Hughes has that one.
It's a Friday afternoon at the Illinois Institute of Technology in Chicago. About 40 computer science majors are scattered in a lecture hall, avoiding the first two rows. Today, the teacher is Sarah Bond, who works at a local fintech called M1 Finance.
Just so I can get some bearings, can you raise your hand if you've heard of agile development before?
One hand goes up halfway.
All right, so it's going to be new for everyone. Great.
Bond is one of a handful of M1 employees, co-teaching a course meant to introduce students to different aspects of working in computer science. The class used to be less practical and more academic. It was taught entirely by Matthew Bauer, who's been on the school's faculty and out of the corporate world for more than 25 years. He calls himself a bit of a control freak who was a little reluctant to share the stage. But last year, Bauer started splitting classroom time with M1 so students could see working computer scientists in action.
I mean, there's different reasons why students maybe don't make it. And we want to make sure that the reason is not because they couldn't picture themselves.
Illinois Tech is private, and tuition is around $49,000 a year. About 70% of students graduate, which is better than the national average, but not where the school wants it to be. Back in the classroom...
Let's jump into the next part, then.
Nolan Grace, an engineering manager at M1, brings the students into groups to work on a financial literacy project. It's meant to give them a sense of what it's like to work for a fintech company. Grace asks students for ideas on how they could present information on student loans.
A TikTok video just like explaining, or like Instagram post, or like a tweet.
Yeah, what do you guys think about that? Some kind of Twitter bot.
Some groups are led by M1 employees who are only present on Zoom.
So... walk me through that. So let's see.
A lot of people are on their laptops, and the students' voices echo when they speak up.
Like, analyze, like, your spending. To look like what you spend on, like...
This was all kind of jarring, and in a world of remote work, realistic. First-year student Araya Pittman says it feels less theoretical than her other freshman classes.
Because we're actually doing it, and then, like, they're an actual company who's still, like, in the makes.
The decision to bring in companies this early was led by a new nonprofit called P33. Matthew Minch is its chief impact officer. He used to work for the Chicago mayor's office and remembers when the city lost the bid to be the second headquarters for Amazon, a marketplace underwriter.
One of the concerns that kind of emerged there was, hey, you know what? I think we need to up our game in terms of developing a technology workforce.
So his organization, P33, connected a bunch of Chicago employees, including those at M1, JPMorgan Chase, and PwC, and had them start teaching at local colleges.
3 years from now, they want to be able to hire a lot of great undergraduates, and this is a way to ensure they have more undergraduates to hire.
Neither the employees nor the companies get paid for the teaching. And still, some say in order to really influence who sticks with computer science and engineering, students need to encounter it even earlier. Michael Hansen is with the Brown Center on Education Policy at the Brookings Institution.
We don't explicitly teach engineering in high school, right? We teach science, we teach math.
At Illinois Tech, first-year Alejandro Martinez says that a lot of what he's learning now is totally new. He's 18 and grew up in Chicago.
I know I've had to ask help over the course of these couple of weeks to actually like know what's going on, since I'm a first year and I'm the first of my generation, so I don't really have that much to piggyback off.
Martina says it's nice to be working with an actual company, but he's also worried about passing his midterms and would love to have more emotional support to ensure that he'll make it. In Chicago, I'm Stephanie Hughes for Marketplace.
Live music got hit maybe the hardest by the pandemic. Concerts and shows were pretty much non-existent, right? But this year, musicians have been hitting the road again, or trying to, and they're running into a lot of really familiar problems. Inflation, high shipping and transportation costs, weaker currencies overseas, one of the challenges of a strong dollar. Marketplace's Justin Ho has more on the new reality for touring musicians.
Let's say you go to your music streaming service and listen to the song June from the album Hymn for Tomorrow by an artist who goes by Rozzy. Don't know how it happened, but I guess the summer's over. Yeah, it's 80 in LA, but you feel a little colder. Rozzy says don't think that by doing that, you're helping her pay her bills.
The money I make from streams is like laughable. Like sometimes I'm lucky to break out of the cents, like literally cents of money, not dollars.
Rozzy says the real way she pays her bills is by going on tour and selling tickets and merchandise.
Live shows is kind of the biggest thing. And it concerns me that it's so expensive to play a live show at the moment, because I'm not the only artist of my size that depends on it.
How expensive? Another artist, Carly Hartzman, the lead singer of the band Wednesday, started keeping track when the band went on tour earlier this year.
I had like a little note on my phone in the notes app, and I would just say anytime we would spend money on gas, I would write minus $70 gas. And then we would get paid for a show, I'd say plus $350 New Orleans show.
At the end of the day, the band was losing money. And then to top it off, one of her bandmates got COVID.
And just like the guilt they had in their voice being like, y'all, like it's over. All right, we have to go home. And I was like, oh my gosh, yeah, it's totally okay. But it's just another piece of context for how things are working right now.
Part of the issue is that COVID backed up the touring supply chain. So right now, the supply of touring musicians is unusually high. Taja Cheek performs under the name Lorraine. She says right now, it's hard to even find venues to play at.
Calendars are booked pretty far in advance because everyone that was writing music during the peak moments of the pandemic are releasing albums.
Cheek says it's also hard to find tour buses and vans. Even the vinyl that gets pressed into records is in short supply.
If a major label artist has a record that's coming out, they'll kind of shut down all the plants and kind of take over.
Some of these problems go back a lot further than COVID. Andrew Leff is a professor at USC and a former artist manager.
The way it used to work back in the day is that, you know, you would go on tour in order to promote your album.
But now musicians have to basically give away their albums in the hopes that someone will hear it, like it, and buy a ticket to a show. He says recorded music has become devalued. And so
more and more artists find it necessary to tour, and that oversaturates the market.
And that's forcing artists to make some tough decisions.
It's kind of a existential crisis going on, with me anyway, regarding being a touring musician.
That's Danita Sparks, singer and guitarist with the band L7. She says short of getting a song featured in a movie or a TV show or taking up dog walking, touring is all musicians can do. This year is the 30th anniversary of L7's biggest album, Bricks Are Heavy. So Sparks says they kind of have to go on tour.
There's only one year to milk that cow.
To cover their higher costs, the band is selling a pre-show experience where fans can watch their sound check, ask questions, and get a bag of merch.
It's almost like an insurance policy for us, because if we do have to cancel a show or two, that can help supplement that loss.
Next year, Spark says L7's been asked to tour the world, but given high costs and health risks, she says she's not sure if they'll be able to swing it. I'm Justin Ho for Marketplace.
This final note on the way out today, you might have noticed there's a word or two that haven't been said on the program as of yet. Twitter, right? Also, Elon Musk. And look, this isn't one of those stories we can just ignore. The richest person on the planet buying a disproportionately influential communications company. But it's everywhere this story is today, so we're going to do it a little differently. About 12 years ago, up at the Aspen Ideas Festival, I talked to Biz Stone and Evan Williams, who, along with Jack Dorsey, started Twitter. So, just for old time's sake, here on day one of Elon Musk in charge, a look back at the very early days of Twitter from two of the founders. Here is me putting a question to Biz Stone. All right, so let me ask you this, though. For all the real tangible news and information and good that comes out of this system that you guys created, what do you do when 99% of what's on there is my cat just coughed up a hairball, right? I mean, what do you do?
And the key thing, I think, is that, you know, people use Twitter every day for whatever reasons, you know, social, fun, organizing parties, whatever it is. And so they're just trained to use it. And so when something does occur, something significant, the first thing you do is you reach for your phone and you make a tweet. And so that means that Twitter gets involved in geopolitical events all around the world. It gets involved in disasters and emergencies. Sort of everywhere something's happening, Twitter is people, and Twitter are there kind of reporting on it up from the scene.
Twitter co-founder Biz Stone back in 2010. Not much has changed about the platform, I guess, and how we use it, but somehow today, kind of feels like everything has changed. We part ways today without a moment of economic context because, honestly, I just spoke too much. So, you know, we'll pick it up again on Monday, all right? Our theme music was composed by VJ Lederman. Marketplace's executive producer is Nancy Fargali. Neil Scarborough is the vice president and general manager. I'm Kai Rizdal. Have yourselves a great weekend, everybody. We will see you again on Monday, all right? This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.